honest, yes, it took me a long time to get here.
Both players have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
All right, Conor, so the news this week is the GAA's COVID advisory group has cleared the way for club activity to resume up into six counties from April the 12th. So fantastic news from anybody or for anybody up there. It has to be stressed that this is club activity, not inter-county activity, because obviously inter-county activity would be giving an unfair advantage to the inter-county teams, the six inter-county teams that would be competing in the National League, hopefully in May. So it's only club activity. Fantastic news for everybody up there, Conor. And the right decision, really, from the GAA. There was some people, I just didn't understand it. I don't want to go over too much about what we spoke about before. They were looking for a 32-county approach. I don't see why those six counties would be punished when it's safe for them to do so. So, you know, very good. I'm currently looking at house prices in the six counties, Conor, if this kind of if this kind of stuff keeps up.
I didn't expect that, Willie, I have to say, but it makes perfect sense. I think you referenced it there, and I think we've chatted about it already, that there was a couple of people in the north, actually in Tyrone and elsewhere, that were suggesting that, well, the GAA, the counties in the north should follow a kind of 32 county approach. But when your own jurisdiction is giving you clearance to resume activity, well, then why not? And had they not, it would have opened up a whole can of worms for what was to stop, you know, GAA clubs maybe using community pitches and stuff like that. If there was teams and other sports being able to train in, you know, train elsewhere, why not the GAA? So yeah. I think, like, the COVID advisory committee probably saw that, and probably saw that, like, the easiest thing to do, and for sense to prevail, is to allow club activity to go ahead. So just delighted for them, and yeah, as you said, slightly jealous that they're a little bit ahead of where we are down here.
Yeah, I'd say they're a good bit ahead, really, because we're talking about potentially having inter-county return on the 5th or the 12th. We know that club can't continue. That's if we go to a level 4 on April the 5th. We're practically, I'd say, the country mentally is on level 4 anyways, based on the numbers. But, like, I mean, the club can't get back onto level 3, which might be a little bit off. So I would say the six counties that are going back on April the 12th will be well ahead, and good for them. But this is the thing. I was looking at the, I'm only joking here, obviously, I was looking at that United Ireland debate on the Clare Byrne show the other night, and the border poll. And if I was Sinn Féin, I wouldn't be pushing this through until this COVID thing completely, you know, fixes itself and our vaccine rollout catches up with the UK, because I wouldn't be too much. If I was in the six counties and I was a GAA man, I might be wondering, here, what way am I going to vote here?
Timing is everything, Willie. Yeah.
what did you make of the bowl, Joe Brawley? Did you see this the other night on Clare Byrne, him getting cut off?
I did. like, you know, I saw Joe's, I have seen Joe's tweets on the night, and I've seen Joe's tweets since. And the man has a point. Do you know what I mean? I mean, like, it's stuff that he was kind of talking about. It's not as if they're baseless allegations. There's stuff that's in the public domain. And anyone who wants to see what Joe was talking about can just go to his Twitter feed to see what he was talking about. But I would imagine, Willie, that RTE were heavily influenced, and I can't speak for them, but heavily influenced by the fact that on prime time a couple of weeks ago or a few weeks back, something was said that led to them having to pay out to a certain group that I'm not going to go into, because, you know, that's treading on awkward ground here. But I'd say that experience that only happened a few weeks earlier probably influenced the decision to take Joe off the air as well.
Yeah, maybe it was. But, like, I mean, I think Clare Byrne spoke to him, you know, almost like a teacher scolding a child. I thought it was a very, very unusual the way she spoke to him. And, like, I mean, she started talking about that Gregory Campbell's not here to defend himself, completely irrelevant. And that's what got Joe kind of going. And then she kind of shouted him down and saying, you know, I'm not going to have anyone call people names. He wasn't. He was saying what the DUP stand for. Anyways, this is a GAA show. But it was Joe Brawley. I don't know. Sometimes he waffles on and he goes on too long. And maybe Clare Byrne just kind of knew that about him and was trying to cut him off. Who knows what was going on there? We'll move on to more GAA stuff here, because Ger Lochnan has written an open letter. I hate open letters. They're so old fashioned, aren't they, Conor? Like, I mean, is the open letter still a thing?
It obviously is for Gerlach Nan. Maybe he's coming from a different era to me and you, Willie. But yeah, yeah.
Just write an article about it. Like, why is this open letter to everyone? Just write a, you know, do an article with Ger about it. If I does it anyway.
So he the latest paper column as well. So yeah, but anyway.
Yeah, write about it. So the latest controversy, obviously in Clare, we spoke about the GPS kind of thing a while ago. I don't know. This one is this controversy. The Sunday Independent and the Irish Times have it, and it's about the Hurling Supporters Club between 2012 and 2015. Now, there was money raised, I think it was 65,000, but Clare County Board had no connection to this supporters club. So this supporters club was, this is my understanding, this Clare supporters club was raising money and it was being spent on the team and it was completely independent to the county board. And I don't know, Connor, is this like a huge scandal to you? Like, I mean, I would imagine this is fairly common throughout the country of maybe managers doing a deal and giving it directly to the players, maybe potentially worried that the players won't see all of it if they hand it over to the county board.
Yeah, well, I'd say it's fairly obvious that it is quite common, Willie. I mean, there's any amount of examples, and like I don't have to look too far away from it here in Mayo, given what's gone on here in the last couple of years. But I think what is happening now, like even Clare have answered this question and said there was they knew it was operating independently of county board, and supporters clubs have been in existence that have operated independently of the county board. But I would say is that like, because of examples like this and maybe other examples throughout the county, is that there seems to be a move to kind of, I don't know, is it stamp out the practice, but to make sure maybe that more county boards are officially aligned with the supporters club. So I know in Mayo here, it's Corgi Mayo. Club Tyrone is a pretty famous one in Tyrone as well. And there's any amount of examples in different counties just to prevent any kind of suspicious activity, Willie, and to make sure that every kind of everything is accountable and the county board can be answerable for it, as opposed to what's the case here in Clare for the years that was in existence.
Well, yeah, I suppose if you're using the county and the county crest and the county, you know, GEA to raise money, well, then the county board, I'm sure they should have that kind of copyrighted, if you know what I mean, that it should without their say. So you should never be allowed to use the Clare GEA to raise money, you know, without them giving you the heads up. I don't know. I just think I don't think it's that much of a scandal, you know, if people are talking about Clare GEA. But anyways, Lochnan continued on the letter. So he feels that they're falling behind other counties. And he said the first half of the last decade brought us so many hurling highlights at underage and senior level that it's difficult to put a hierarchy of satisfaction on these. My own highlight was the under-21 All-Ireland final in Thurles in 2013, a game that was sandwiched between two epic senior finals in Croke Park. That is never to be forgotten in a never to be forgotten September. That's incredible, actually. The draw with Cork in the All-Ireland final, had a replay against Cork in the All-Ireland final, and had to play an All-Ireland under 21 final. I remember that going on at the time, and they had so many fellas crossing over that time. He says, what made victory so special was towards the end of the game, Clare youngsters of various ages seemed to emerge from nowhere and begin lining the perimeter of the field, hurleys in hands, waiting for the game to end. There seemed to be thousands of them there, and just as the final whistle sounded, they resembled a stream of locusts as they stormed onto the pitch. Like, I mean, it just, like, Clare won that senior All-Ireland. They won an under-21 All-Ireland hurling in 2012. They won three in a row. Then they won the senior All-Ireland 2013. And they won the under-21 in 2013. And then they backed up that senior All-Ireland with another under-21 in 2014. And since then, they only won one National League at senior level. And they were lucky enough to win that against Waterford. It was a dodgy enough free towards the end that Tony Kelly got. Like, I mean, it's a massive underachievement when you think about it, Connor, isn't it? Like, I mean, to have that much talent, that many players coming through, for them to reach the pinnacle so early, that pressure being off them, and not even get a Munster or, you know, an All-Ireland appearance after it.
Yeah. Like, I suppose it has to be taken into context. The two main kind of under-21 hurling victories that stand out to me were, I think it was Tipperary in 2010 and Clare in 2013. And there's a danger in kind of falling into the trap of, oh, well, this team is obviously going to dominate for years. You know what I mean? And it rarely works out like that. But when a team is so successful as that Clare team, as in when they put them back to back to back, you know, three in a row, and they had won the senior one, as you said, for a young team to win a senior, that that must be a huge weight off their shoulders, because there is that air of expectation. Once you've got it done, and once you've got it done early, it should really set the platform for you to go on and kind of, you know, dominate, or at least make more of an impression at senior level than Clare did, you know, because like there's been a lot of really good hurling teams over that, like that tip team eventually, you know, came good, won a couple of All-Irelands, Kilkenny obviously, and then the emergence of Limerick and Galway. So it wasn't just the underachievement of that Clare team, but they have, like, what sort of impression have they made at all? I mean, the only thing I can remember is when they got to the All-Ireland semi-final against Galway,
yeah,
and Galway beat them by a point after a replay in Thurles. And you can look at that and you can say, if they beat Galway that day, they could well have beaten Waterford in the final and gone on to win it. But that's really been the only thing. And if you're a Clare fan, considering the level of potential and the level of player that triumvirate of 21 teams kind of produced, it really is a kind of disappointing track record since 2013 in particular.
It definitely is. That kind of age group is pretty much, you know, on their way towards, you know, their late 20s, you know, I'm sure. Now, like the Limerick under 21s of the early noughties, 2000, 2001, 2002, they won three All Ireland under 21 titles in a row. And this was this big kind of, you know, what happened to those three teams? They didn't even win a Munster. They only made one Munster final out of those three All-Ireland under 21 winning teams. They lost in 2007 to Waterford. They ended up beating Waterford then in the semi-final. They made an All-Ireland final, but they only made one Munster final. That's a massive underachievement, and we always remember them. Clare will never be seen as an underachievement because those young players won an All-Ireland, and what can you do more than that? I suppose maybe it'll be seen as an underachievement, but at least they got the All-Ireland. Like, they can turn around and say, look, we won an All-Ireland from those underage teams. Galway, obviously, like, I mean, how many minor and under 21s do they have to win without dominating at senior level? One thing I always find these examples is the Clare and Limerick examples, because they're under 21s, and under 21s going on to underachieve at senior, I find, is more difficult to understand than minors. Like, I mean, we had an incredible, we underachieved Laois footballers at senior level. We only won one Leinster from a brilliant crop of minors, 96, 97 All-Ireland winners, finalists in 98. Then we won a Leinster in 2003. And in that same year, 2003, the minors won the All-Ireland final. So we had another batch of good minors coming in to an already established team. And, you know, for minors, it's a lot different. You're 18, you go to college. How many drop off from college? It's much more difficult. I always find with an under 21 team not going on, you've gotten past the college years, you know, the gut maybe potentially going off the rails years. You're a little bit more mature. I always find it harder to understand how under 21s don't go on ahead, you know, and win the All-Ireland, you know, or win at senior level rather than minors.
Yeah, well, as at under 21, you're as good, especially these days, I suppose, given like levels of strength and condition and stuff. You're fully formed. You're nearly fully formed when you're under 21, as opposed to when you're, well, it's under 17 now, county level. So there's so much more development to go into. And there's a chance that people will fall off the level before they get to senior. So it's harder to understand. But the only thing I'll say on that, Willie, is that I think it's easier to it's easier to say about a team like Clare, who won three back to back, that they should go on and, you know, they should go on and really achieve something. Whereas I think it's too much to me is made of a team that might win one All-Ireland or something like that. Or, you know, because they might have beaten a team by a point in the All-Ireland final, you know, for example. And that team who won it is expected to go on, whereas the same expectation level isn't of the team that they beat.
Yeah.
And yet they were nearly at the same level. Sometimes I find that is leveled at under 21 teams, where there's not that history of success. It might be only a one-off, but like in Limerick's case in the early 2000s, and in Clare's case that we've just spoken of, when you have that level of success and when that team is staying together and that team is being brought through to senior level, well, then that's harder to understand if they don't translate it, as opposed to, as you said, with the minors.
Yeah, and obviously you could have a very good under 21 team that wins in the final against another team that has maybe six exceptional players, and maybe the other nine aren't that great, and the other team is a better team. But who makes it better into senior? The team with the six exceptional fellas that go up and improve the senior team, rather than the very well-rounded 15 that are an excellent team. You know, that probably needs to be pointed out as well. We spoke about O'Neill shorts on last week's show, where we were kind of laughing about the O'Neill shorts. And I was just reading a really good piece in the Killarney Advisor during the week. It was a piece written by Adam Moynihan, and it's about Adidas sponsorship. in the GEA. So it's a long piece, and I'd advise anybody to read it because I thought it was very good. So in the late 1970s, Adidas tried to make the breakthrough into the GEA world. They approached GEA teams to wear their gear. This was obviously a fairly controversial thing to do because the GEA had very strict rules preventing any teams from wearing foreign brands. So what Adidas did to get around the rule, they set up a partnership with a clothing manufacturer in Donegal called McArthur's. So they approached Cork and Kerry. I think they approached Kerry maybe in 75, 76 about wearing boots, but they approached Cork and Kerry in 1977. And both of them wore the Adidas gear. The entire Cork squad got suspended for 6 months by the Cork County Board. Frank Murphy decided to suspend them. The Kerry County Board didn't suspend their players at all, because the bald Mick O'Dwyer kind of saw a great opportunity, you know, with this Adidas gear and this Adidas deal, and he convinced the Kerry County Board that this was a really good deal. Adidas had kind of thrown a carrot in front of Mick O and said, look, we'll stick a few quid in your end of year holiday, this round the world trip. Mick O thought this was fantastic, told the county board whatever. So Cork for wearing Adidas gear, their county board suspended them 6 months. Kerry, on the other hand, out of their 8 All-Ireland wins, they wore Kerry gear for 7, I think it's 7 of the 8 of them, they wore Adidas jerseys. So, like, I mean, they were really ahead of their time, Kerry, back in the late 70s, Connor.
Yeah, I'd only heard glimpses of this before. I think it was mentioned in the Mikko documentary, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Whenever that was on, he was really ahead of his time. I like, he was a bit of a style icon and kind of liked his image and liked his cars and stuff like that, and knew how to. He was Del Boy before. Well, I suppose Del Boy would have been known at the time through Only Fools and Horses, but he put Harry Redknapp in the shade the way he was wheeling and dealing. But it's really the Adidas that I'd associate with Kerry would be in the late 90s, where they wore that jersey for a couple of years, and that kind of that didn't last that long either, and probably wasn't as nice. But I didn't realize that they hadn't that they wore the Adidas gears for so many of their All-Ireland wins. But it's worth saying, Willie, you did say that Cork suspended their squad for 6 months, but it's worth pointing out that that was for county only, and by the time the suspension expired, Cork hadn't actually played any games.
I know, yeah, they were knocked out of the chat. It was obviously knockout, and by the time the 6 months were up the following year, although the league probably started before Christmas. I don't know. I think that might have been the case. But anyways, the Kerry players were rarely seen out of the Adidas gear, so they went to press nights wearing the gear. They wore Adidas branded jerseys for the team photos. On match days, Kerry warmed up in Adidas tracksuits. The substitutes wore Adidas tracksuits on the bench. They used to hide the Adidas logo for matches to get around the kind of ban or whatever that the GEA kind of had. Like, I mean, it's just, I can't get my head around it, that this was really going on back in the early 80s. I remember in the mid-90s or the late 90s, fairly sure it was the late 90s, maybe early noughties, this Club Energize deal. Maybe it was the noughties. The GPA did this Club Energize deal, which was fairly controversial. So remember this going on, Connor, whenever a player would be interviewed, you know, on RT or whatever after the game, to take the drink out of the Club Energize bottle. And, you know, you mightn't notice it until you're told it. And then every interview, they're swigging out of this. So this was kind of controversial. But like, to think that Mikko was thinking like this back in the early 80s.
Yeah, and just, I was thinking about that as well. And you have to think that, like, so this is obviously pre-internet, right? And this was when, you know, people's exposure to TV would have been maybe two channels. And obviously that, like, they wouldn't have been seeing much of English football or anything like that. So in terms of, I know they didn't always get to wear them on the TV, but like, Mikko was ahead of his time there in thinking that an association with this. I mean, like, if the Kerry players, who were the superstars of their era, are seen to be wearing this, and then that's obviously having a huge impact on, like, you know, kind of, people are seeing this on TV, or people are seeing the Kerry players in this gear and they want to be in that gear as well. And then Mikko, aware of the impact that can make and the financial benefits that was going to bring to Kerry as well, which they obviously did for holidays and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, the Energize stuff, Willie, I associate that with maybe 2004, 2005. And I was going to ask you, like, was there ever a directive to players at the time to, like, were you told to, like, if you're pictured in, you know, if you're doing a post-match interview, have you told blatantly to make sure you swig plenty from the Club Energize bottle and make sure it gets on TV?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I don't know if it was 2004. I don't know. I don't have much of a recollection of it. I was thinking it was the late 90s there. That'll tell you what my memory's like. I don't know. I don't remember actually actively talking about it. I remember more seeing it on television. I don't know, Connor.
Do you remember the one thing that comes to mind? Because I remember a couple of GA players doing it, but nobody as blatantly as Brian O'Driscoll was spotted drinking the blue Powerade bottles, the blue Powerade, I think it was around mid-2000s, and he did an interview and he couldn't have been more blatant. I mean, he might as well have just shoved the bottle in front of the camera.
A lot of them were being blatant, and then obviously there was a big controversy because the Gooch went with Lucozade Sports. So Lucozade Sports saw this going on. Oshie McConville, Desi Dolan, I think Brendan Cummins, own Kelly, and a few more of these lads. They went with Lucozade Sports. So there's a big controversy. I really enjoyed it. I actually can't remember. I don't think I wasn't a member of the GPA. I figured out very early in my career, after being initially a supporter of the GEA, I was looking at fellas getting these club energized deals. I was looking at fellas getting their picture up on these billboards because of the club energized. I was looking at different deals players were getting, and then I was looking at myself thinking, here, what the hell am I getting out of this? I'm signing up to this, but it's only the two or three players on the panel that are making anything out of it. I says, I'm getting very little back out of this. And I kind of pulled out. No, because it's important to point out that one of the very earliest GPA meetings, there was a speaker from the PFA in the Premier League, and he said what the likes of David Beckham, I think, was the example he used, that if he got a big deal, half of the money or a percentage of the money would go back spread amongst all the members, and he would get the other half. So I was like thinking, yeah, that sounds fair. We're all in it together. But as it turns out, it was just the three or four getting everything and everybody else got a hoodie. So I was like, this isn't really kind of what was kind of promised in one of these early meetings. So I kind of lost interest in the GPA at that stage.
Yeah, but then, like, now that you mentioned that, William, thinking of and Bernard Brogan went into a fair bit of detail in his book about, like, when when Pat Gilroy came in and was kind of speaking of the need for Dublin to kind of, make the most of their commercial potential, and having players like Bernard Brogan and others, that, like, the deal was that, like, yes, actively pursue this sort of stuff, but that the benefits you get from it, a lot of it goes back into the players' fund and then can be put towards, whatever Dublin needed to kind of enhance their training or whatever equipment they needed, or whether it was just for a few quid for the lads. So, like, that's coming. That's as late as 2010. So that was probably a few years afterwards. But I would have thought, I would have expected, as you said, that part of the deal, especially for the GPA, was that, the players that are, having their faces out there, maybe because they're a bit more well known, that it eventually comes back into the panel for everybody else to get a cut out of it. But yeah, obviously not if you're only getting the hoodie.
Yeah, and what I didn't like was in the very initial Club Energize deal, Jason Sherlock got it, which I didn't have a problem with because Jason would be very high profile, but Senan Connell got it as well, who wouldn't have been high profile, and they're both Nafina club mates of Desi Farrell. When I saw that, I went, here, I'm out of this bloody GPA. I'm not having anything to do with it. Anyways, just back to this Adidas thing. So I'm going to finish up this. A lot of listeners probably know some of this stuff. It was the 1980 final, and the night before the 1980 final, I'm not sure was this in Miko's documentary, maybe a bit of it was, but it was mentioned briefly. So the GEA Director General Liam Mulvihill and President Paddy McFlynn, they called out to the hotel in Malahide where Kerry were staying the night before the All-Ireland final, and they pleaded with Miko. They brought out a full bag of O'Neill's gear, green and gold, and pleaded with them to wear this. Imagine this now, the best team in the country. Imagine if this was happening now, Connor, the controversy that would be going on around it. Like, I mean, the best team in the country, the best manager in the country, and they're blatantly telling the GA, no, we're not wearing what you're asking us. So they came in anyways, and Miko told them to think about it or whatever. And when the lads left the hotel, Miko told them, like, I mean, this isn't going to happen. And anyway, they went out, won that final. They ended up getting fined in 1983 for refusing to accept the GEA directive for the last few years. And Miko says they ended up getting fined €500 for wearing the Adidas gear, but they got 20,000 out of Adidas for the few years. So, like, I mean, imagine Miko laughing. I think he did say that in his documentary.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, he did. He did reference that one. I'm not sure did he reference the 1981, as you said, but if he didn't, I would advise everyone to go back and read that piece that you mentioned from the Kerry Advertiser, because it's really interesting. It's really, really detailed, but really interesting. But just listen, another example of how far Mikko was ahead of his time.
Yeah, exactly. One last bit from this article as well was 1981, Mikey Sheedy. So he was a Puma man. He had done his own Puma deal. It's generally free takers get these deals. Although, like, I mean, there's loads of examples of non-free takers. But I couldn't believe that Mikey Sheehy back in 1981 was getting a boot deal. I couldn't believe it. And anyways, so he's got his own Puma deal, and Kerry have done a deal with Adidas. So Mikey's like, here, geez, Mikko, I'm comfortable in these Pumas. I like them. I've got my own deal. And like, I mean, even Mikko back then, Mikko says, I don't care what you wear. This is Mikey talking now. He says, the important thing is the team, and you don't need to do anything. Keep wearing what you're wearing, but give them to me. I'll do a job on them. So Mikko took the Puma strip off the side and planted three stripes, the Adidas three stripes, just so Mikey would be comfortable in his Puma boots going out in the match.
Was that not a clear breach of his Puma boot deal? I'd say the Puma lads were onto him immediately after.
Yeah. The only person that suited was Mikey's comfort.
Yeah.
I'd say that the deal was probably ripped up. He didn't get a penny out of it. That's a good point. I didn't actually think of that at the time. Anyway, this story got me thinking about boot deals. I'd no boot deal when I was playing. I was a little bit jealous of the lads that actually had. But one man that did get a boot deal, he was with Adidas for a while, is Conor Mortimer, and he joins us on the line now. How's it going, Mort?
All right, well, not too bad, man. Getting through it, same as everyone else, I think, just about surviving.
Exactly. I think that's all we're doing. We're just getting by. So, come here, you were with Adidas. How did this all come about?
Go back, Willie, I suppose, 2000... Oh, I think it was 2002 or 2003, maybe 2004. One of them years. Anyway, basically, Adidas had gone. There was 6 or 7 of us. I'm wrong there. There was probably about 15 of us that got asked at that time about Adidas coming on board, about wearing their boots and you get a load of gear or whatever like that. And I mean, look, I suppose it was changed for nothing, really. There was no real conversation about it. It was just a matter of, yeah, of course, get us on board. I think it was myself, McDonald from Mayo, Ken McGrath, Paul Galvin, Cooper, O'Shea, the three O'Sheas, I think, actually. Who was looking after Wilson? Wilson, Harty, PR, they were kind of in charge of the whole event and stuff like that. It was a big day for it, into Dublin. Obviously, be aware, obviously, the boots on the day, there was a mixture of boots, Predators, World Cups, blah, 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 at that time. You didn't really get a choice at that time. You just put on the boots for photo shoots and stuff like that. They'd use in the papers, I suppose, closer to your games. Like, everyone had different interviews for different days, if you get me, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then the day before a game, it'll come out and you'd be wearing your Adidas t-shirt, shorts and boots or whatever like that. Wasn't a hugely big pickup at the time. There was obviously a few, I suppose, snides in your own dressing room, considering you were, I suppose, getting this gear and, I think it's fairness or whatever, but that's who they went after at that time. I think it was kind of the more, obviously, good players, but standard different type of players as well who were asked to wear them at the time, because there wasn't a huge amount. I think Trevor at the time was with Puma, and some guys were getting some from Umbro. There was a little bits and pieces going here and there, but there was nothing major. I mean, the Adidas one was probably the best one at the time. I think we got, $2,000 or $3,000 maybe, and I think the whole contract might have been worth maybe $5,000, so you get a couple of grand worth of gear and boxes and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Right. So you'd go into their catalogue and you'd pick the boots and the gear you want, and you get the few quid then as well?
No, I was always a Predator, whatever type of Predators were at the time. And then you have a bag of gear in your size. You wouldn't particularly pick it.
Right.
But all the same guys would get the same gear, if you get me. You know what I mean? So you could be at something and that he can have added the same top on or whatever, you know what I mean? But big, big bags of stuff, man, at the time it was, that we got. Now, we used to be getting, what did I get that time? Jeez, you could be getting, like, you'd always be saying, oh, my boots are after bush, and you could be getting maybe 10 or 12 pairs of boots in the summer. Like.
In the same summer, what would you be doing with them? Selling them?
I suppose you'd be trying to wear them pretty much as much as you can and give them away or do whatever you were doing with them. I see a lot of them, boy, the difference with Adidas at the time, when you were getting your boots, they were made in Germany boots. They weren't your made in Taiwan or made in China.
Right.
The Predator in Germany. If you go into a shop tomorrow and look for a pair of Predators, they're very unlikely they'd be made in Germany, you know what I mean?
Okay.
World Cups are, if you buy a pair of World Cups, you know yourself, they last you probably an eternity. Predators won't, but the Predators we were getting were German Predators. They're pretty much the professional made boots that last you probably. I had two or three pairs there that I got back in the day, man. I still have them. They're still perfect boots, like.
Right. And how long were you with Adidas then? So you got through your first year. Like, would you have a review with them at the end of the year? You know that they got enough exposure out of you, or how long did you end up staying with them?
Oh, chat to Tom. I used to deal with a guy with Paul Maloney, just checks or whatever. I think I was 3 years there getting stuff off them. And then they went to Munster during that period to look after Munster rugby. And it kind of quietened down the GA side then, do you know what I mean?
Right.
That happened at that time. There was an awful array of boys with Adidas at that time. But when they went to Munster, I think the guy that looked after us was looking after Munster. So it quietened it down a little bit in relation to who was wearing them and what people were getting. Now, I think, by all accounts, you know, I've heard stories about the O'Shea's, man, when they went to Dublin to the warehouse, drove in, filled the car with Adidas and home, you know what I mean? As opposed to getting our stock sent to us or whatever, you know, but probably the best part of 3 years, but really.
Right. Okay. And did you continue wearing Adidas after that? Obviously, you have a huge stockpile of boots at that stage, or would you, you know, maybe say to Puma, here, I'm out of that contract, they're not paying me anymore?
No, I've worn Adidas since I was a kid. I've never worn any other boot, really. I wore Umbro Specialis, actually, in a minor final in 2000 or 2001, I think it was. Black Umbro Specialis. But I wore Adidas Predators after that for the rest of my life. I still wear them today. I still haven't changed. Now, there was a time, I think I said it to you yesterday, I think it was before the 06 All-Ireland final. I was waiting on boots to be delivered. We always got new boots for the final. Usually a couple of weeks out. But
just with the panel, was it?
No, Adidas used to
give with Adidas.
Final with the dates on them and all that crack, you know.
Right.
But they were delayed and we got them the night before the All-Ireland. So obviously couldn't wear them in particular. But I had met a guy that week. I think Puma were kind of coming on stream in a few places at that time. They were getting a little bit bigger with players. And we got Puma boots for a week before the All-Ireland. I wore them on the Tuesday and Thursday before the All-Ireland. Jeez, they cut the ankles off me. We were getting lump sum or whatever, I think, to wear them in the final. I said I'd try it anyways. Obviously, I think in them days you'd have done that for a few, Bob.
Yeah.
But didn't end up wearing them anyways in the end. But no, I did that. I pretty much worn them pretty much all my life, really. But I was saying there, was the German, you can get a pair from Germany, man. You can get them today, wear them tonight. No problem. It fits your foot like a glove.
Well, I thought that was the same with all kind of boots after the 2000s, because I remember being a young fella and you'd have the boots in the 90s and you'd wash them and you'd have to put Vaseline on them because they get rock hard. I thought the boots had gone to the stage during the noughties that they didn't cut you. You know, you didn't need that breaking in phase, or maybe that's just the boots now.
I think it was maybe the boot. Because I suppose it was a Puma boot that I was wearing as opposed to an Adidas boot. Maybe, I don't know. I couldn't get used to the very particular boot, man. Because they were very, a lot of the time, as the years move forward, the boots are getting plasticky and they're getting lighter. And they're, you know, the Predators we used to wear then, when you were playing the same as me, man, were thick boots. Like, they were thick leather. And if they got wet, they were like bloody rocks on your feet. But when they were summer boots, there was a great thing off them, where you wouldn't even, like, I would have found a lot of time with boots, man, hurting your foot kicking them, and particularly in today's boots, because they're so thin, you know what I mean? And there was no tongue on, there's no tongue on a lot of boots these days. They're like soccer boots, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, they come back to the German boots, man, they're just a different grade of boot, really. But they say it costs, I think, about 150 or 160 to produce a boot in Germany as opposed to Taiwan or China. Because they're any of the contracted boots you'll find there, Beckham or Gerrard or whoever, with Adidas, and they get their boots, they're always made in Germany boots. They're not made in Taiwan or made in China or any of these guys. That's where the general bulk would find in sports shops. You know, now I know one or two of our lads did, I'm not sure who, went to Germany to get their foot molded. So if you get your foot molded, you can get every boot sent over to you. You can wear it any day of the week you want. Brand new boot out of the box because it's specifically for your foot. I know, I think Pádraig Joyce might have did it a few years ago.
Really?
Like, if I recall. Now, he wore World Cups pretty much all the time. But look, at like a lot of stories where he probably grew legs over the years. You know what
might I mean? Have, yeah.
Got the job in June. Now he's getting more.
Come here, you mentioned Puma coming in for you for that final, because I was reading Owen Mulligan, he was with Adidas the same as yourself. Other Adidas were, you mentioned a few of them, Stevie McDonald, Paul Galvin, then the hurlers, Tommy Walsh, Dan Shanahan, Joe Canning were all Adidas back then around your time. Muggsy was Adidas too, but his contract expired for the 2005 final. And he said, I was still wearing the Predators when I scored the goal against Dublin. Before the All-Ireland final against Kerry, Nike came in for five of us. Me, Brian Doer, Peter Canavan, Philly Jordan, and somebody else. Sean Kavanagh was with Puma. They offered us serious dough just to wear them in the finals. So, like, I mean, Muggsy, obviously, because there is a bit of a difference, Mort, when you're used to wearing Adidas non-stop and then you look down and there's a Nike boot on your foot. It takes you a while to get, not break them in because you'll break them in, but just to look down at your foot and not go, what's that?
Well, there's a huge difference, man. Like, I've always, you know, I don't know, I mean, maybe it's just me, but when you're kicking balls, you're kicking frees or whatever, man, you always... You know your boot, like, I mean, if I went out tomorrow with a different pair of boots, I wouldn't have near as much confidence in my, rate to kicking than I would with a pair of Adidas that I've worn on my life. Definitely not.
Yeah.
And I always, okay, and then by that time, you know, it's a huge risk, man, because when you're, it's like wearing anything, well, you're doing something that you're used to doing with a specific boot. You know what you're doing all the time. And when you change that, you know, especially in an All-Ireland final, I mean, regardless of what you're being offered, you know, I mean, they were lucky, I suppose, they won the game in the end. But
yeah, well, I don't know if all five wore them now. I think he's saying that they came in for them, so I don't know, did they all take them up on the offer?
Two who wore them in the final.
Right.
That time, did Nike on that day. There was a big, big bunch of them at that stage, but I know Klucko went with Nike for a while. It's kind of like when you hear the fella who's wearing them, what he asks, what's the story with that? Oh, there's a ref called Michael. So then you get Michael's number and you text him, here, what's the story with getting a few pairs of boots? And away you go, you know what I mean? That's kind of the way it was for a while, you know?
Right, because that was the thing. Like, I would never have had the bottle. Ross Munley was Puma. We were there, I think Tom Kelly might have got Adidas boots, because I remember he had his name stitched in them, and you pretty much had to have a deal to get your name stitched in them. Other Puma fellas were DJ Carey, Henry Shefflin, Trevor Giles, Kieran McGeaney, Michael Donnellan, Daryl Kaneda. They were always with Puma. I never really liked Puma. I never really liked the way they looked. I always found them to be like the older lads on the panel would kind of wear them. But, like, I mean, when it came to the stage that you'd get the Mort stitched into your boots, this must have been a huge moment in your career.
Yeah, it was kind of an upset, man. I suppose, you know, I think anyone who's a keen interest in soccer, man, you see every soccer player in the world has their name in their boots, whatever, and you're kind of, I think it was after when they came and they're stitched in, as opposed to, I don't know, was it always, you could order up Pro Direct and have your name on them or blah, blah, blah. I don't really know, because I wouldn't have bought boots that often online, but, you know, it's obviously, it's looking, I suppose, you know, it kind of adds to the ammunition for people you're playing against. So that's the one thing I would always say. I mean, people would say you're arrogant and you're this and you're that, and then you go with your name in your boots and you have your name on your shorts. And you, like, I see people even today, name on the runners. Name, I do it myself, man. A lot of gear that I buy, it has my name on them. Not so runners and red tops for training, whatever it may be. And I don't know, it's just... I suppose when you get out of the system and out of the limelight, it's no harm to remind people your name.
Well, it's obviously very good for the thieves on the panel. They can never wear your gear back to training then.
Yeah, exactly.
And come here, I have to say though, it does work. Like, I mean, I can tell by you, you're able to tell me Dour wore those Nikes in the 2005 final. Like, I'm thinking of Dear McConnelly when he wore the Warrior boots. Like, I took an interest in what are these boots now? And I think Bernard Brogan might have worn Warrior, and I'd never heard of Warrior boots at that stage. And now I'm searching these boots, and they're pretty nice boots. And the same with New Balance when they came into it, a few of the Dublin players wore it. Like, it absolutely works for these boot manufacturers. Like, the amount of players that notice, and I'm not going to buy a pair of Warrior boots because Dear McConnelly or Bernard Brogan are wearing them, but I will notice what they're wearing, and I will say, geez, they look like a lovely boot.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. The marketing for boots has you know, changed upscale for pretty much donkey's years, because you go back a few years, everyone was probably wearing Adidas. Everyone was probably wearing a specific boot. You could literally go back 15, 20 years, and you see everyone on the pitch wearing the same same boots pretty much, whatever was going at the time. I mean, we had Elvries with Mayo for a number of years there, and yeah, you can pick and choose your boots generally, but sometimes you might just only have a choice of World Cup or Mundials or whatever. They're pretty the same. There's no doubt that, and I think it's, you know, those players that you've named there, pretty high profile players as well. I mean, you're going to say, as opposed to, you see a cornerback from bloody, I don't know, wherever, some a Division 3 or 4 team, and he's wearing a pair of Mizuno's. I know Kevin O'Neill, Billy Joe Padden, big Mizuno guys. No matter what offer they've ever got, Mizuno, because that's what they're into. But, you know, there's no doubt about it, they do sell. And if someone is wearing them, you know, as you mentioned, you're going to say, geez, I'll try them. Now, I go back to even the Warrior boots that Conley and that worn. It kind of shows the difference, whereas it just shows probably the better quality that he would have, I suppose, as opposed to, and confidence in himself that I would have in myself, because I wouldn't change like that, where he'll go out and wear a different boot, yet he'll still perform the same. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was no difference in performance, man. It didn't really matter. And that kind of goes... There's always an argument, I suppose. It doesn't really matter what boots you have. It did to me, but obviously it doesn't to him. The same with Bruno. You know, that. And look, it takes them time to, I suppose, get used of those particular boots. I know Conley was working it with New Balance, and Warrior was a big thing. I know McCaffrey wore them for a couple of spells. You know, it's funny when you see it, but, you know, it'd be interesting to see the stats in relation to, you know, sales of those boots after a particular game, whatever.
Yeah.
The Warrior and that, because, I mean, Dublin, any young fella looking at a Dublin player and he's wearing this, right now, I mean, I want that for Christmas. I want this for Christmas.
It's a no-brainer. Like, I mean, it's a no-brainer. Like, say, for example, then in 2002, you were getting $2,000 or $3,000, you know, a couple of big boxes of gear and 10 pairs of boots. Like, I'm not talking about Dear McConnelly or Bernard Brogan. I'm just even thinking of, because both of them are finished up now. Like, what would the very top players do you think be getting now? Like, I mean, are you looking at $10,000 and then unlimited boots and unlimited gear or some sort of a deal like that for boots?
Well, I think, well, now, due to the fact, you know, I go to the likes of Aidan O'Shea or these guys. I think they have a lot more bargaining power now. Someone comes in, offers you $5,000. No, sorry, it's not enough. I'm going to go with X, Y, or go to Adidas and get 10. I think that wasn't there in our time, where it is now.
Right. There's a lot more options.
There is. And there's a lot more, you know, I suppose coronavirus hasn't helped in relation to getting, you know, looking at star players and marketing players. But I definitely think that, you know, there's a lot more different boots out there now as opposed to the ones then. I mean, you have a various, any array of boots now that people wear. I mean, even some guys wear ASICS boots and stuff now around the place. I mean, it's, you know, but I suppose the bargaining power that some players have, but I suppose it boils down to the team you're playing with as well. I mean, obviously O'Shea would be a big name. Killian O'Connor would be a big name. Any of the Dublin players, man, if you're on the Dublin team and you're going to talk to some company about wearing whatever boots, man, you have serious bargaining power, because you're going to be in the limelight. You're generally going to be there all around a semi-final or in the final, and there's a good chance you'll do an interview and mention, you know, I've, you know, you put in whatever way you want to put it in. You're wearing fucking Adidas or wearing Nike or whatever it may be on that particular day. And it's, I'd love to know the, I suppose, the ins and outs of the finances, how they can kind of corresponded back into, right, Jeremy Connolly wore these boots in our final day, we're after turning over this amount from that particular day. It's very interesting to see those numbers, because that's what companies will boil it down to. They don't do it for nothing, you know.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I don't know, Mort, how many people will have enjoyed this conversation, but I've enjoyed it because I have a very keen interest in boots, as you do. Come here, thanks very much for taking the call.
Well, take it easy, man. Talk to you soon, bro.
All right, great stuff from Mort there. Moving on, I saw Alan Quirk. There was quotes in the Examiner. He was on a Cork webinar from goalkeepers, Conor, and he must have been listening to the show last week when we were, or 2 weeks ago when we were talking about goalkeepers and how sensitive they are. He said, sometimes maybe we take ourselves a little bit too seriously as goalkeepers. He says, and then he goes on to talk about the different skills of goalkeeping. And he says, there's five principles of goalkeeping: kickouts, shot stopping, handling, general football skills, communication and organisational skills. Now, I would put handling and general football skills in the same, you know, kind of category. But he went on to say, which I thought was an interesting one, he says, a key part of a goalkeeper's development to potentially becoming one of the best of his trade is to play outfield at club or school's colleges level. And I can see the logic behind that, Conor, perfectly. Like, I mean, you know, the goalkeeper now has to be an all-rounder and he needs to be good on the ball. He needs to be an excellent kick passer, but he needs to have the ability to take a ball under pressure, etc. Now, the issue I have is, how good is he outfield? Like, I mean, you can't just go to your club manager and say, right, I'm an intercounty standard goalkeeper, but I don't want to be a huge asset to the team. I just want to be a bit part, maybe a liability as a wing back or a wing forward.
Yeah, and what if you've no other keeper? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then you're putting somebody who's obviously not up to it in goals just so your intercounty keeper can play outfield. So,
yeah.
Like, I get where he's coming from, but, like, you know, everyone has to cut their cloth to suit their measure. I mean, if it doesn't suit your club team, if you're either not good enough to play outfield or if there's nobody good enough to play in goals instead of you, well, then it's just not going to happen, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's it. Cluxton tried this when I was with Parnells. Interestingly enough, he told the manager he wanted to play outfield. And, like, I mean, Cluxton has notions that he's a good outfield player. And Cluxton's brilliant on the ball. He's an excellent kicking technique. You can see that from, you know, when he plays in goals. If he's kicking points unchallenged, he'd probably be more accurate than me. He's great control of his left foot, you know, curling them over the bar. But just because you're a good kicker of the ball doesn't mean you're a good forward. He wanted to play wing forward. And, like, I mean, he was probably wouldn't have been a senior level wing forward. And he's by far and away the best goalkeeper that's ever played the game. And I'm like, how is this even a conversation? We've an average wing forward, you know, he's an excellent kicker, and we've the best goalkeeper of all time. What is going on? I said to the manager, I says, tell him to cop on.
Was he doing this, Willie, as what you said with Alan Quirk there about trying to improve his, you know, a part of his development to become a better keeper? Or was he just doing this because of, you said, his notions that he was a decent wing forward and should have been playing there instead of playing in goals?
Hard to know. We'd have to ask Cluxton, only he never does interviews. Yeah. Maybe Cluxton, being the legendary goalkeeper that he is, maybe he was thinking that far ahead and he was thinking of improving his outfield skills. Who knows? I think he just enjoyed kicking points and was bored in goals. That was my theory on it. You know, but anyways, that I just thought it kind of jumped into my mind when I saw Alan Quirk. I think it's a non-runner. If you're an intercounty goalkeeper, you're a huge advantage to your club as a goalkeeper. Now, there obviously are exceptions to that rule. Or, like, if Cluxton wanted to play outfield, if the club was at junior level, he'd probably be a good, really good outfield player at junior level. But, like, I mean, at senior club level, I think it's a bit disrespectful at senior club level for an intercounty goalie to be demanding to play outfield on that team.
Yeah, well, especially if he's keeping better players off the team in the wing forward line, and especially if Parnells are going to be better served with him in goals, which I imagine you would be at that stage where you were playing them, you were playing for the Mully. There was a few more kind of outsiders playing for them as well. It would have been one of the top clubs in Dublin at the time. So, like, it makes perfect sense for me to be for Stephen Cluxton to be in goal as opposed to being wing forward. Like, you could say if two county standard goalkeepers happen to be at the same club and your inter-county goalkeeper is a better outfielder, you know, than the other one, then it makes sense maybe, you know, when you know that somebody, you know, your number two is nearly as good as you, and then you can, and you as a number one are good enough to play outfield. But, like, I'd say the circumstances where that applies would be quite rare. And then you might have situations like you had with Parnells when somebody is demanding to be playing outfield where it's not for the good of either themselves probably or the team.
Yeah, James Horan was talking to local media. He's on the Mayo News for the first time since the All-Ireland. And I had to laugh at this kind of sentence. He was talking about the All-Ireland win, and it's like how to speak without saying anything at all. This is kind of like the Jim Gavin, Eamon Fitzmaurice. James Horan's obviously perfecting this. He's talking about the All-Ireland final. And he says, we look very honestly at what we did and what we tried to do, how we tried to play, and look back individually and as a group and take learnings from it and go away with those and try to build and improve and grow and develop for the next game. Like, I mean, it's such, isn't that such waffle? But like, you could be thinking about that going, very kind of interesting, you know, as a group, not individually, just, you know, as a group, develop next game. It's, you know, it's gobbledygook really, but I don't want to be too critical of James Horan because he does get a bit more specific later on. I just wanted to give that sentence. I always remember interviewing Eamon Fitzmaurice after games, and he'd always say the same thing. There's a lot of things that we want to work on. We wouldn't be entirely happy with that performance. And I'd always say to him, like what? There'll be a few things, you know, that we'd probably have to watch the video now to be able to give you a good answer on that. And now, you know, that's completely gone, but he's just pawning you off. But when he did get a little bit more specific, okay, this first part isn't specific. It says there was a couple of bouncing balls we could have won. That's not specific at all. A couple of hand passes that if they went through, a couple of basic things under the highest pressure or the highest pace that you can do them, that's where it's at. Okay, so he didn't really get specific at all. But, like, I mean, here was the thing, you know, that, oh, yeah, then he goes on to say decision-making. Like, I was always wondering, you know, decision-making, James Horner is kind of talking about things that they can improve on. Is decision-making something you can really work on? I know you can talk about it. So say, for example, Mayo had a couple of moments in the game where a bad decision, you know, a move broke down. Now, like, I mean, I remember when I was playing, like, my decision-making at times could be terrible under pressure up near the goals because I would have been a bit like a fish out of water up there. And I don't know if I could necessarily improve that, or I don't know. There's not necessarily drills you can do to improve decision-making. Maybe it's just meetings, talking about it, seeing examples and thinking about it yourself. Maybe this magical thing of visualization maybe comes into effect here, where you need to picture scenarios that when that happens in a game, that you're not going to panic and give the stupid ball.
Well, so there's a couple of things in this, buddy. Like, I would, like, James Horan ticked all the, like, there's a number of boxes for the James Horan bingo that were ticked there, like, in terms of learnings and develop and grow and all that sort of stuff. The one thing I will say about him is that he, you know, he does practice what he preaches as well. It's like, he's always about kind of, you know, skill levels, and, you know, when he was a pundit, he used to wax lyrical about Dublin and their individual skills and stuff like that. And I think that ties into decision making to a certain degree. So you would have, when you watch Dublin play, for example, and their execution, so like their decision making has been improved by the fact that, like, let's say if it's the right decision to make a pass with their left hand, they're able to do it because they've improved their skills to that level. Do you know what I mean? And you can replicate the environments where you have to make those decisions as much as possible. So, like, you always think with Dublin, for example, when they get a 3-on-2 or a 3-on-3, that a goal is on, because they've done it so many times, and they've replicated that environment so many times that you expect them to deliver. Now, at the same time, I think you can try and replicate that those environments as much as you want, but I still think there's an elite level player, you know, the really top level players, that they're just, yeah, you can practice as much as you want, but they have something about them that you just know that they're going to make the right decision 90 to 100% of the time. And there's an element of it that's not coachable, just because they're really the best of the best. But
yeah, I think that's what separates the very, very top players, is their ability under pressure to make the right decision. I don't know, can you practice that as such? You know, like, and yeah. I'm as a pundit, I can see exactly what you should do in a scenario, but when you're on the pitch, I didn't always take that right. Like, I could give some terribly stupid passes on the pitch, and you look back and I could see it in a match, something that I was actually doing, geez, and I'd be like, well, that, you know, that's this terrible decision making. But when you're under, I always find your decision making, when your confidence isn't that high, you double guess, what should I do here? And then you're completely gone. All bets are off at that stage. Then you don't really know what to be doing. Or then your manager gives you instructions to do something and you're wondering, do I want to impress him by doing what he tells me? Or is that the right thing to do in this scenario? You know, and these things are rushing through your head, and then your brain scrambles. And I often find, when I often made the wrong decisions on the field, it was because I was double guessing, either am I doing what I'm being asked or what I think is right here.
Yeah, and especially sometimes sometimes when you have the time to second guess yourself, if that makes any sense. So imagine if you're running through on goal with 30 yards to spare and all these scenarios are kind of run through your head. Do I place it? Do I try and rattle it? All that sort of thing. Whereas if you got the ball from on the burst, for example, and you just hit it on instinct and, you know, you just smashed it to the net or something like that. But like on that, like I think if you take a raw player, for example, a player who's quite raw, they are coachable to a certain degree. Do you know what I mean? They can improve massively in loads of different aspects, but that element of rawness, I think, will still remain. And I think it'll still remain mostly in their decision making under pressure, as you say. Whereas there's, as I said, there's an elite level who just have that. And this is a personal thing. People will feel free to disagree, obviously. But I just think that the really, really separates the cream from the crop is that they just have that natural instinct to always make, or to most of the time make the right decision. Yeah. And no matter how much improvement you can make, or no matter how coachable you are, that you might still be missing that compared to the really, really top players.
The example I always use was when I was put in at full forward. But Colin Brown put me in full forward and Mikko put me under full forward. But like, I'm always happy enough to admit, like, I mean, with my back to goal, I wasn't an accurate full forward. So I was happy enough to put me in as a target man full forward. And my instructions were get out in front of your man and lay it off to lads running past you, which I was more than happy to do. But you know, when you get a ball sometimes and you can feel that your man sees the fella running towards me, knows I'm going to give him the hand pass, yeah, and actually peels off me to hit this fella a good slap. Like, the right thing to do in that scenario is to dummy the pass to him and go the other way. But then if that goes wrong, I'm getting absolutely peeled by the manager. So I've often, not often, but on occasions, I've given that hand pass to the fella knowing that this move is going to break down now, because, you know, I didn't have the confidence to just use the dummy and go the other way, because it was being hammered into me. I'm only there to throw off the ball in that role.
Yeah, well, like, I suppose not to kind of rat on you, Willie, or whatever, but the best of the best then will, no matter the specific instructions provided to them, and that is...
I'm comfortable with that, Connor.
No, that's fair enough. We'll realise that the best thing to do is to throw that dummy solo, or to throw the dummy pass, and then to go yourself if you have the confidence to take the shot on, because then you become, as useful as you are as an outlet in the full forward line, you become predictable as the guy who, you know, if you do that for 5 games in a row, the opposition looking at you will say, well, this guy isn't going to shoot, lads. You know, so, you know, just maybe give him the chance, because all he wants to do is lay the ball off. So we have to be ready to meet the guys who are going to be coming off the burst, because that's what he's going to do. That's what he's always going to do. And that's going to put you off as a result.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. But I suppose after maybe having 2 or 3 games of impressing them, I was able to maybe then, you know, add a couple of little bits into it. But at the start, I absolutely had to follow, you know, the instructions that they were telling me. Quickly, Paddy Durkin was talking actually this week as well, and I was surprised to hear this at this level of sport, Connor, that he pulled his quad 3.5 minutes into the game. Now, he played on because you can feel a little niggle and you're going, oh God, oh no, Jesus, I hope this doesn't go. And then just before the water break in the first half, he went running, sprinting, and it went. Like, he gave it a pull where he knew it was gone. Went off at the water break, told the medical team, and amazingly came back out onto the field to mark Kieran Kilkenny in an All-Ireland final. I would have thought those days were gone at this very, very serious level.
Yeah, well, especially for a muscle injury like that.
Yeah, you don't run that off.
No. And a player like Paddy Durkin, who is so explosive, do you know what I mean? Whose whole game is based on kind of bursts of pace. Do you know what I mean? Like, I was amazed. I think most Mayo fans will say about that game that we didn't realise till the halftime break that Paddy Durkin was in trouble. So maybe, I don't know what that says about Paddy Durkin, that he was able to disguise it for the second half of that water break, playing against Kieran Kilkenny, who was quiet. And I know Paddy Durkin said he mightn't got much ball or whatever, but Kilkenny was really quiet. And I think that owed a lot to how Paddy Durkin played. But like, nowadays, if he told the medic and if he told the management, I do find it baffling that he stayed on the pitch, as important as he was, you know, arguably Mayo's best player. Still, I just find it very strange that with that, like, Paddy Durkin hasn't gone back training since. He's not back fully training since as a result.
Right.
That's 3 months ago.
That'll tell you how bad it was. Yeah, it's incredible, really. Even for his own player welfare, like you say, like, he could be out for 6 months if he was to go back out and do that again. And you, like you say, Paddy was very honest about it. He says, I don't think necessarily it was my brilliant defending or anything like that. I thought we played better football in the first half as a team. There wasn't that much ball coming into him. And that's true. And, like, I mean, probably count your blessings that Paddy didn't come out in the second half, because Dublin kind of took over a lot more than they did at Mayo, the better team in the first half. So Kilkenny obviously got more ball, and Paddy, you know, the quad could have been, you know, seriously damaged, you know, by then. But I definitely thought at that level of sport that if you come off at the water break and you say, here, look, no, I'm after giving it a pull, you kind of have to be taken off at that stage with a muscle injury. I'm going to leave you with this one, Conor, because this kind of annoyed me when I read it. This is the GPA this week. They're hosting a series of videos for all of its membership, and they're trying to give them tips on the social media minefield. I know all about it. So
have they got you in to speak to them?
Well, I could give them some advice. Well, I wouldn't give them the same advice as this Kieran File fella. So he's a professor in linguistics and he's the MD of Reactive Sports Media. So he's talking to these GAA players about their use of social media. And like here is the kind of tips he's given them. So he's given them tips on players who are looking to create brands for themselves on social media. So he says, what aspect of your athletic story are central to your identity? What other aspects of your identity do you want to share with the world? Design a strategy for enacting this brand. What posting behavior will help you directly or indirectly establish and communicate your brand on social media? What makes you unique? What story do you have to tell? Oh my God, like, I mean, is this fella actually for real? Like, I mean, I've built up a fairly good following on Twitter, and the idea that any of this, like, I would tweet something without even, almost like I'm sending my friend a text message. Then he goes, continues on, he says, under the headline, are you managing your reputation on social media? Footballers and hurlers are told to share contact that makes a positive contribution to people's day and to be tactful. Make managing your important relationships an important consideration when you design your post. Like, you think you're talking about a work of art here, Conor. You're designing a tweet. Like, I don't know. It just sounds so contrived to me. Like, why can't the advice to these GAA players be yourself? Don't be stupid on social media. Don't draw any unwarranted attention to the team on social media, especially during the season. But be yourself if you want to be yourself. This is, to me, this is just like, oh.
I'm just picturing you, Willie, in the morning thinking, before I tweet today, what aspects of my athletic story are central to my identity?
Yeah. Or how will I add to my brand today and then start giving out about COVID or something?
how will I enact my brand before putting a poll out on the Late Late Show on it?
here's the thing though, Conor. Like, I mean, I often say, well, with my Twitter, like, I mean, my Twitter will kind of reflect the mood I'm in that day. For example, if I'm having a really bad day and I'm getting really frustrated about the whole COVID thing, you know, or I'm stuck in the house, or, you know, I might tweet 3 or 4 times about COVID that day, giving out about it. But is that not just me being myself? Nobody's perfect. And if you want to vent, or if you want to say a couple of things, that's your own personality. Like, people might think you want to give out about somebody. Like, what's wrong with being yourself? I don't get it why you would try to think so deeply about social media. Should you not be yourself on social media? Is the point I'm making, is that not the best advice you can give anybody?
Yeah, well, I would have thought so as well. I would have thought that is what social media is for, Willie. But like, say the paragraph that you read out there a while ago about, you know, designing strategy for enacting the brand and posting behavior and all that sort of stuff. I suppose, like it or not, I suppose that, like, GAA players now, that's their brand or their profile on social media is, like, it's a legitimate kind of career direction for them to a certain degree, in terms of, like, there's money to be made there in terms of association with brands and stuff like that, and potentially thinking of a career in, you know, career post their GAA career, if their reputation, if their profile is high enough, that's a definite road that they can go down. So. Yeah. So maybe they're thinking that if they're too aggressive on social media, that's going to affect their the ability for brands to associate with them and affect their earning potential in the process.
Maybe, but like, I mean, all panels are made up of different characters. Like, who are the funny ones? Who are the sarcastic ones? Who are the grumpy ones? Like, should that not be reflected? Like, should we not be able to tell? Oh yeah, we can see what he's like. You know, on Twitter, he's a gas man. You can clearly, like, if this is the kind of advice they're getting, we never know any sort of personalities injuries in teams. Like, I mean, even the day of, I'll always remember, I think it was 1992, and I have a very clear recollection of this. Laois beat Meath in up in Navan, and Meath had been like the team that couldn't be beaten. They actually were beaten in the 91 final by Down, who were brilliant, and Laois beat them away in Navan. And I remember, like, in 1992 I would have been 14, and I remember being on the hill, had great memories, really, really hot day. And I remember walking back down to the bus. We were there with the football team with Portlaoise under 14s, and I remember Desi Farrell being close to me as I was walking down, and he was just in his normal civvies walking down with his gear bag around him, and there was all the Dubs clapping him on the back. And I just remember being a young fella looking at Desi Farrell like, oh, Jesus, this is just a superstar.
Yeah.
Like, players now don't even walk down out of the ground with the fans. They don't even go down and have a pint in the pub with the fans anymore. Like, you don't even see them around. They get into their tracksuits straight after the match, get into a bus and might go and sit in an ice bath or go for their meal. That connection is being broken all the time. Maybe I'm showing my age or something and I'm not able to identify with the game now. And it's obviously changing. But I think it's sad that these players are being told to be this corporate and this contrived on social media by the GPA. And the connection is growing wider and wider and wider between the fans. Am I overthinking this?
No, you're not overthinking it at all. Like, but like you do make a point there in terms of what that was 92, 91, 92. And in this day and age, if you can imagine if somebody was walking down the street, you know, to a game like that, there'd be 500 pictures up on, you know, on Twitter or on social media, and they have to be conscious of that and kind of the impact that makes kind of maybe on themselves and on the team as a whole. Like, you, the point that you were making there in terms of I would like that as well, Willie, if somebody was confident enough in their own character, do you know what I mean, and confident enough in their own common sense that they could be themselves on their social media channels, for example. But they have to be, can they also, you know, cope with the fact that somebody might be in their ear telling them, oh, you have to be, you know, that's doing us no good or anything like that, or that's you need to be quiet or stuff. I wish they wouldn't, but probably, you know, for their own protection, or for their, you know, protection of the county team, whatever, is that intercounty players are being told of the need to be cautious and to be very careful about kind of how they put themselves out there. And like, it's a shame in terms of we don't get the characters maybe that we used to. They're not maybe as kind of as present in as you said, like the Desi Farrell stories, they used to be. But it comes back to, this is probably the world we're living at the moment, and it's a bit of a shame that they can't be like that.
Yeah, or maybe I'm just getting old and giving out and getting a little bit grumpy. Right, Connor, we've probably gone way over time there. Only one interview, but loads to talk about this week. We'll leave it there, and we'll come back again next Thursday with another show. So we'll talk to you all then. Good luck.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop. And when I got the chance to go, I said I'd still go, so I opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through. But it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know. And it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken. I let it go, because I won't see you later when we're not allowed to talk.